Whatever becomes of Professor Duncan's statement, I'll make one, myself, and that is that, if nobody looks up, or checks up, what the astronomers tell us, they are free to tell us anything that they want to tell us. Their system is a slippery imposition of evasions that cannot be checked up, or that, for various reasons, mostly are not checked up. But at least once there was a big checkup. The 24th of January, 1925 excitement in New York City. It was such as, in all foreign countries, is supposed to arise in America only when somebody finds out a new way of making dollars. It was the morning of the eclipse of the sun, total over a part of New York City. Open spaces in Central Park were crowded down to a line, as exactly as possible at 83rd Street. Up in the air were planes full of observers. Coogan's Bluff was lively with scientific gab. Hospitals were arranging that patients should see the eclipse. There was scarcely a dollar in it, and this account will be believed, in England and France, no more than will most of our other accounts. At the Fifth Avenue Police Court, Magistrate Dale adjourned court, and went, with lawyers and cops and persons out on bail to the roof. In Brooklyn, the Chamber of Commerce dropped all matters of exports and imports and went to the roof. I don't suppose everybody was looking. I can't accept homogeneity. There were probably some contrary ones who went down into cellars, simply because most of their neighbors were up on roofs. But the New York Telephone Company reported that when the eclipse came, not one call came into one of its offices, for 10 minutes. When there are uproars in New York, they are such uproars as have never been heard anywhere else, but I think that most striking in the records of silences is this hush that came for 10 minutes upon New York City. Along the line of 83rd Street, which had been exactly predicted by the astronomers, as the southern limit of the path of totality, and in places north and south, were stationed 149 observers, sent by the New York lighting companies, to report upon light effects. With them were photographers. At Petropavlovsk, Kamchatka, and at Kashapoyas, Peru, an eclipse is all that it should be, and books by astronomers tell of the minute exactness of the astronomers. But this was in New York City. Coogan's Bluff got into this. There were cops and judges and gunmen on roofs, and the telephones were silent. There were 149 expert observers, who were not astronomers. They had photographers with them. In time, the astronomers did pretty well. But, hereafter when they tell of their refinements, as with discs several hundred miles away, I shall think, not of 50-cent pieces, but of Ferris wheels. Their prediction was wrong by 4 seconds. The 149 observers for the lighting companies reported that the astronomers were wrong, in space, by 3/4 of a mile. It was the day of the big checkup. If the sun and the planets compose a system that is enormously remote from everything else in existence, what is it that regularizes the motions, and why does not the mechanism run down? The astronomers say that the planets keep moving, and that a whole system does not run down, because space is empty, and there is absolutely nothing to tend to stop the moving bodies. See Abbott, The Earth and the Stars, p. 71. Astronomers say this early in their books. Later, they forget. Later, when something else requires explanation, they tell a different story. They explain the zodiacal light in terms of enormous quantities of matter in space. In their chapters upon meteors, they tell of millions of tons of meteoric dusts that fall from space to this Earth, every year. Abbott says that space is absolutely empty. Ball, for instance, explains the shortening of the orbit of Encke's comet as a result of friction with enormous quantities of matter in space. I don't know how satisfactory, except to ourselves, our own expression will be, but compare it with a story of an absolute vacancy that is enormously occupied. There is a tendency to regularize. Crystals, flowers, and butterflies' wings. Proportionately as they become civilized, people regularize, or move in orbits. People regularize in eating and sleeping. There are clockwork Romeos and Juliets. Everywhere, where the tendency is not toward irregularization, the tendency is toward regularization. Here's a good specimen of my own wisdom. Something is so, except when it isn't so. Not in terms of gravitation, but in terms of this tendency to regularize, celestial periodicities may be explained. Why does not the mechanism of what the astronomers think is a solar system run down? The astronomers say that this is because it is unresisted by a resisting medium. Why does not a heart run down? Anyway, for a long time. It is only a part, and, as a part, is sustained by what may be considered a whole. If we think of the so-called solar system, not as a virtually isolated, independent thing, with stars trillions of miles away, but as part of what may be considered an organic whole, within a starry shell, our expression is that it is kept going organically, as the heart of a lesser organism is kept going. Why does not the astronomer's own system, or systematized doctrine, run down, or why so slow about it? It is only a part of wider organization, from which it is receiving maintenance in the form of bequests, donations, and funds of various kinds. Our opposition is a system of antiquated thought, concerned primarily with the unthinkable. It is supported by instruments that are believed when they tell what they should tell. The germ of the system is the fall of the rising moon. Its simplest problem is a fairy theorem, fit for top-heavy infants, but too fanciful for grown-up realists. Its prestige is built upon its predictions. We have noted one of them that was 3/4 of a mile wrong. Newtonism is no longer satisfactory. There is too much that it cannot explain. Einsteinism has arisen. If Einsteinism is not satisfactory, there is room for other notions. For records of eclipses during which the stars were not displaced, as, according to Einstein, they should be, see Indexes of Nature. See volumes 104 and 105. Displacement of spectral lines. See records of astronomers who have disagreed. Perihelion motion of Mercury's orbit. Einstein calculated without knowing what he was calculating about. Nobody knows what this eccentricity is. See records of the transits of Mercury. Neither Newtonians nor Einsteinites have predicted them right. See the London Times, April 17 and 24, 1923. Here Sir J. Larmor shows that, if Einstein's predictions of light effects during eclipses were verified, they disproved his theory that, though Professor Einstein would be a great mathematician, if in our existence anything could really be anything, relativity is so against him that he is only a relatively great mathematician, and made a bad error in his calculations, having mistakenly doubled certain effects. Defeat has been unconsciously the quest of all religions, all philosophies, and all sciences. If they were consciously trying to lose, they would be successes. Their search has been for the absolute, in terms of which to explain the phenomenal, or for the absolute to relate to. Supposed to have been found, it has been named Jehovah, or gravitation, or the persistence of force. Professor Einstein has taken the velocity of light, as the absolute to relate to. We cannot divorce the idea of reciprocity from the idea of relations, and relating something to the absolute would be relating the absolute to something. This is defeating an alleged concept of the absolute, with the pseudo-idea of the relative absolute. The doctrine of Professor Einstein's is based not upon an absolute finding, but upon a question. Which is the more graspable interpretation of the Michelson-Morley experiments? That no motion of this Earth in an orbit is indicated, because the velocity of light is absolute. Or that no motion of this Earth in an orbit is indicated, because this Earth is stationary? Unfortunately for my own expressions, I have to ask a third question. Who, except someone who was out to boost a theory, ever has demonstrated that light has any velocity? Professor Einstein is a Gerard Dist of the scientific revolution. His revolt is against classical mechanics, but his methods and his delusions are as antiquated as what he attacks. But it is my expression that he has functioned. Though his strokes were wobbles, he has shown with his palsies the insecurities of that in science which has been worshipfully regarded as the most high. It is my expression that the dissolution of phenomenal things is as much a matter of internal disorders as the effect of any external force, and that the slump of so many astronomers in favor of Einstein, who has made good in nothing, indicates a state of dissatisfaction that may precede a revolution, or that, if a revolt starts in the observatories, hosts of irreconcilable observations will be published by the astronomers themselves, cutting down distances of planets and stars enormously. I shall note an observation by an astronomer, such as probably no astronomer, in the past, would have published. It seems to have been recorded reluctantly, and a conventional explanation was attempted, but it was published. I take from a clipping, from the Los Angeles Evening Herald, April 28, 1930, which was sent to me by Mr. L. E. Stein, of Los Angeles. In an account of the eclipse of the Sunday, April 28, 1930, Dr. H. M. Jeffers, staff astronomer of Lick Observatory, says, "We expected the shadow to be but half a mile in width. Instead of that, I think that it was nearer 5 miles broad." He says, "It may be suggested by others that the broad shadow was cast by astronomical errors due to the moon being closer to the Earth than we have placed it in theory. But I don't believe that this broad belt was caused by anything but refraction."